Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading the Midland Reporter-Telegram for Friday, October 16th, 2020. Lee football coach wants to unify school through name change. By Christopher Hadorn, C-H-A-D-O-R-N at MRT.com. Lee head football coach Clint Hartman said mentoring kids and unifying the school is his objective after the Midland ISD board voted Wednesday night to change the name of Robert E. Lee High School to Legacy High School. The name change won't go into effect until the 2021-22 athletic season, so the school's athletic teams will play out the rest of this school year as the Lee Rebels. Although the school name will be changed to Legacy, the school's colors will remain maroon and white, and the Rebels' nickname was retained but will be a rebel from the Revolutionary War era. I have a job to do, and that is to coach football and lead our athletic department at Midland Lee, Hartman said Thursday. We will mentor kids during this change and work hard at unifying our school. Next year, when the name change starts, we will work toward those goals. Hartman and number 18-ranked Rebels are preparing to visit their historical rival Odessa Permian in Friday's 7 p.m. District 26A opener at Ratliff Stadium. I wish our kids would have had a chance to have a voice, Hartman said. All I can do is lead them through it. That's all I'm going to do. I'm going to see where this goes, because you never know. I spoke to our kids this morning. I had to tell them, hey, we're still the Lee Rebels this year. Breathe. And we'll have to see what happens. There's a bunch of opinions out there, and I'll let everybody have their opinions. What I'm going to do is coach the heck out of these football kids. Before the team's season opener in September, Hartman gave an impassioned speech in front of Lee supporters and parents at the Meet the Rebels event. Hartman said he felt the need to back his football players because quarterback Mickey Serrano received a negative backlash on social media after telling a TV station, "The Rebels are back." Hartman said the name Robert E. Lee was never mentioned in his locker room. He said his locker room was an environment where socioeconomic status doesn't matter, where his players unite as brothers for a common cause. Adults make decisions and we'll respect them, and our kids have their voice. We'll see how the dust settles. Today we're trying to answer questions that we won't have to answer to. We're just waiting to see how this all shakes out. The name change has led to many people asking him if he's going to stick around as head football coach. He said he's here to coach the football team for the long haul, whether it be Lee or Legacy. People ask me if I'm leaving, Hartman said. No, I'm not leaving. My job is to lead our football team and our athletic department, and that's what I'm going to do. And I'm going to coach them hard and love them harder, just like we continue to do. Once things start getting implemented next year, we'll support whatever we need to do. MISD board opts to not go with committee's name recommendation by Stuart Doreen, S-D-O-R-E-E-N, at HurstMP.com. It probably wasn't surprising to many inside the auditorium at Bowie Fine Arts Academy that the Midland ISD board did not approve the Citizens Renaming Committee's number one selection, Legacy of Equality and Excellence High School. But within moments of the name being voted down Wednesday night, committee members realized they were going to get shut out when it came to their other recommendations. Trustees didn't take another vote. After the board voted down Legacy of Equality and Excellence, Trustee Robert Marquez made his motion for Legacy High School, a name that was not among the committee's recommendations. It's disappointing that none of the recommendations were accepted from our committee on the name, said Shannon Lowe, a committee co-chair, after the meeting. But you know, we're going to get behind our kids and we're just going to move on. Lowe said the 23-person committee spent so much time narrowing down the list of name nominations to the final three, Legacy of Equality and Excellence, Tall City High School, and Carver Lee High School. They spent hours going over procedures and had meeting after weekly meeting, listening to each other's heartfelt testimonies. People put a lot of effort into it, Lowe said. At the end of the day, this is about kids, and we're going to get behind them, and we're going to move forward. And you know that it's not the building or the name on the building that defines you. It's the people inside it. And so that's not going to change, and we're going to move on. The process is going to be a sore point with some people in the community. While there was always the possibility that the board could decide against the committee's recommendation, that was difficult for many to accept. Board member Tommy Bishop said during the meeting that people were asked to serve and a vote for a legacy of equality and excellence would let them know their service counted. Bishop also said he visited with students at Robert E. Lee High School, and the current rebels told him they wanted to keep Lee because that's what they know. Ryan Murray was the other member to side with the committee with his votes on Wednesday. He said afterward that the committee followed policy to a T, and they actually went the extra mile because they made sure they did it legally. Murray was the lone board member who voted against changing the name at Robert E. Lee High School and Freshman School during the July meeting. "I just really thought we should have stuck with the committee's work," said Murray, who also said he was pleased there were things we were going to get to keep. He mentioned specifically LHS, the mascot Rebels, and the colors of maroon and white. Legacy of Equality and Excellence was meant to allow for the acronym LEE, which was done for a Robert E. Lee school in San Antonio, and was a goal of many inside Midland Lee District who want to hold on to nearly 60 years of tradition in sports, other extracurriculars, and academics. It became known publicly on Sunday that Board President Rick Davis would not support the acronym, something he said changed during the process. "Initially, I was admittedly open to the possibility of the LEE acronym option and said so, but after continuing to listen to people's reaction to the acronym and praying about it, I am now persuaded LEE High School does not go far enough in disassociating ourselves from having a public school named to honor a Confederate general who fought for the Southern state's ability to continue the abominable institution of slavery." Davis also stated that board members were never in favor of the LEE acronym. Of the committee's work, Davis stated, "There are those that assert that any failure to accept the committee's recommendation would be an act of disrespect for their efforts and would amount to a dismissal of their work as irrelevant. It would not. The committee was asked to make recommendations to the board as what the new name should be, but it was made clear the board retained the ultimate decision-making authority. The committee's work is very much appreciated, and their suggestions fostered a community-wide discussion that helped everyone to formulate their opinions about the issue and communicate those opinions to the board members." Murray referred to Davis's October 11th opinion article in the Reporter-Telegram as being ridiculous. He said after the meeting he didn't like that the board president forecast his vote days before the meeting. "He does carry a lot of weight with the board," Murray said of Davis, "so when he signals what his vote is, then it kind of puts everybody else at a disadvantage if you're not in his group." My reference to that was we had an email September 2nd that I was copied in on and that said the acronym is totally acceptable. And then the committee voted on September 17th, and that was their final vote. "Well, when that article comes out on October 11th, and it contradicts what he already told them," he said. Lowe said that board members stated from the beginning that an acronym was not acceptable. It might have resulted in the committee being on the same page as board members, who ultimately voted for a clean break from not just Robert E. Lee, but Lee itself. "We were trying to direct the group as best we could from the knowledge that we had. A better understanding of what was absolutely expected would have definitely helped guide us. But you know, I'm proud of what we came out of the committee with, and I think that our process was fair and it was just. In the end of the day, it's out of our hands, so we did what we could do." Prayer rally held for Bob Fu as protests continue. About 200 people attended a prayer rally Thursday at the Horseshoe for Pastor Bob Fu, who has been in protective custody for the last 2 weeks as protesters picket in front of his home. The event was organized by the Texas Pastoral Council and local supporters of Fu, the founder of Midland Prophet China Aid, which provides legal assistance to Christians facing persecution in China. Those gathered sang hymns and joined in prayers led by visiting pastors. One of the local organizers, Ilele Rosa, opened the rally and told the crowd they were there to send a loud message to the Chinese Communist Party that communism is and will always be intolerable in West Texas. few did not attend the event but phoned in to thank his supporters. "Let freedom ring," he said in a phone call that was broadcast through the Horseshoe Amphitheater. Fu said he and his family are outside Midland and being protected by law enforcement officers. He encouraged those in attendance to not take freedom for granted and said the Chinese government is participating in spiritual warfare to target dissidents. "This is the moment we show we are a one body of Christ," he said. "The road to freedom for China still needs every part of the body to fight together." Several Chinese immigrants who are now living in the U.S. after fleeing from the CCP are also in attendance. Guo Baxing, no relation to Miles Guo, the billionaire whistleblower believed to be targeting Fu, said he too was recently targeted by Guo. Baxing, a former pastor and writer with 100,000 followers on YouTube, said in an interview that he became a target of the businessman when he posted on social media 2 years ago that Guo was an operative with the CCP. Guo then sued him, and 2 weeks ago their conflict escalated to the point that Guo sent protesters to Baxing's home in Virginia. Baxing said he was granted a restraining order against Guo because of threats Guo had made in videos posted on social media. Rosa said Guo's campaign to target dissidents of the Chinese government is evidence the CCP has agents in the U.S. He called on Americans to be educated about communism and act against it. "We need to fight," he said in an interview. "We need to stand up, and at least if we are to fall, we fall fighting." Protests continued in front of Fu's home Thursday, with demonstrators standing in a line holding signs that read, "We didn't threaten anyone," and "We want to talk to Patrick Peyton." Midlander Mayor Patrick Peyton held a press conference Thursday evening to provide an update on the protests. During that press conference, Peyton said he would have a conversation with the protesters if they requested it and met with him without recording it. He apologized to Fu's neighbors for the disturbance the protests have caused and said the city of Midland was doing everything it could but could not do more to remove the protesters without violating the First Amendment. Peyton said the city would honor the protesters' right to freedom of speech if they kept the demonstration peaceful. 4 protesters have been arrested so far for either trespassing or jaywalking. Board Meeting Notebook: Cost of the Change and How They Voted, by Stuart Doreen, S-D-O-R-E-E-N, at HearstNP.com. The decision to just change the name and not the colors of Robert E. Lee High School and the freshman school appears to have cut the rebranding cost nearly in half. Changing the name and school colors would have run $3.469 million, according to an MISD preliminary branding cost study. However, just changing the name lowers the cost to $1.797 million. That cost includes $1 million for facilities and $610,000 for athletics. The greatest costs include $325,000 for signage, $262,000 for a contractor's project cost, $258,000 for gyms, and $249,000 for football. Here's how the votes went. To vote on Legacy of Equality and Excellence as the new name for Robert E. Lee High School, motion by Brian Murray, seconded by Tommy Bishop, voted down 2-5. Murray and Bishop in support, and Rick Davis, John Trasciti, John Kennedy, James Fuller, and Robert Marquez against. To vote on Legacy High School as the new name for Robert E. Lee High School and vote for maroon and white colors, motion made by Marquez and seconded by Kennedy, voted for 5-2. Trinity, Davis, Kennedy, Fuller, and Marquez in support, and Murray and Bishop against. To vote for Rebels as mascot, the rebel would be one of the American Revolutionary War era, and ultimately to be picked up by the Lee student body, voted 7-0. Students to pick the depiction of the mascot. One piece of unfinished business is that depiction of the mascot has not been selected. Board members did unanimously approve the Rebels as the mascot, and these Rebels would not have ties to the Confederacy, but to the American Revolution War period. The plan is to allow creative renderings, even possibly having art students at Lee High School participate in the process. Participating citizens' renaming committee members will then pick two options. Those options will be sent to school administration, who will then allow the student body to make the ultimate selection. There might be certain changes that take place immediately, but district officials talked more about gradual changes. It was stated during the meeting that the school name won't officially become Legacy High School until after the end of the school year, but that might stop the implementation of some changes. Robert Marquez talked about being elected to make decisions and that unfavorable positions were not supposed to be moved down the road. Marquez said there is no proof that any board members can erase history and that ultimately a Lee name would continue to divide students. Tommy Bishop talked about his choice. He said he went to Lee High School this week and talked to the students about the name change. I am a voice for kids. That is what I stand for. James Fuller talked about voting for Legacy of Equality and Excellence. He wouldn't vote for it, given the historical ramifications, and that the decision represents a retreat, a lack of courage, and a move to hold on to the past. Brian Murray talked about going to the Lee campus and not seeing that racism, and going into a locker room and seeing people who support each other and have a common cause. He listed polls and surveys that showed support for keeping Lee in the name. John Kennedy, in talking about a vote against the committee's recommendation, complimented the committee for its work, but said it was the board that ultimately would make the decisions. He said the renaming process was to come up for a name change for Lee. He added that there will still be teams in an opportunity to celebrate the past. John Trasheedy said he had no interest in debating history. He said the traditions will not go away and that this process offered no middle ground and no ability to compromise. He said the board's charge was to change the name of Robert E. Lee and that there is no greater power for those in disagreement than the power of the ballot box. Rick Davis, in reacting to the social media polls of students and people in Midland about whether to change the name to Robert E. Lee High School, said majorities are not always right on issues like this. He used Texas's secession, Midland officials not allowing black students on campuses before desegregation, and the naming of a high school in Midland after a general who fought for the southern state's ability to continue the abominable institution of slavery. City reports 50 new coronavirus cases, 88th death, from staff reports. The city on Thursday reported 50 new cases of coronavirus, bringing the total during the pandemic to 4,397. The city also reported the 88th COVID-19-related death. A man in his 80s who had underlying health conditions died Wednesday at Midland Memorial Hospital. This patient is the third coronavirus death reported this week. The health department also said there are 1,439 active cases and 2,636 people have recovered. Thursday's new cases are reflective of lab results from Wednesday. State and local news. Concho is an attractive acquisition target, analyst says, by Paul Takahashi, Houston Chronicle. ConocoPhillips' efforts to acquire rival Concho Resources, reported Wednesday, reflects the oil industry's growing appetite for consolidation, despite the risk of alienating investors worried about company spending and declining returns during the ongoing downturn. The Houston oil giant is in talks to buy the Midland shale driller and its assets in the Permian Basin, according to a Bloomberg report citing unnamed sources. ConocoPhillips said it doesn't comment on market rumors, and Concho didn't respond to requests for comment. The acquisition would be one of the industry's largest this year, as companies look to pool resources and cut redundancies to weather the oil market's boom and bust cycles. With oil prices hovering around $40 a barrel, it's making it easier for companies to be able to transact, said Michael Leary, a partner at law firm Hunt & Andrews Kurth in Houston. People are getting more confident in the market conditions, and everyone agrees that consolidation within the upstream industry needs to happen. This wave of mergers and acquisitions in the industry runs counter to promises by a growing number of energy companies to rein in spending and focus on boosting shareholder returns after years of disappointing results on Wall Street. Investors since 2018 have pulled out of the energy sector, abandoning shale drillers who require a constant stream of capital to drill new wells and replace rapidly depleted older ones. Energy is currently the worst performing sector of the S&P 500 stock index. That's the challenge for the industry, how to attract investors back, said Jennifer Rowland, a senior energy analyst with Edward Jones. With a poor track record of mergers and acquisitions, it's hard to spin that story forward. ConocoPhillips CEO Ryan Lance acknowledged this reality this year, saying in public interviews that oil and gas companies must learn to live within their means, increase shareholders' dividends to attract Wall Street investment. How do we get value investors and energy investors back into this business? Lance said in an interview with market research firm IHS Market in June. That's going to be a function of giving money back to investors and modifying your growth so there is a heavy focus on returns and return of capital. That's what's going to get investors excited again about the exploration and production space. Yet, ConocoPhillips didn't close the door on growth. Lance in April told CNBC that ConocoPhillips was on the lookout to acquire smaller companies as their market values plummeted with the price of oil. The time is ripe to pick up valuable assets on the cheap. It got to be accretive. It can't destroy our financial framework, Lance said. April 30th on the network's Power Lunch, but we're watching acquisitions closely. Publicly traded energy companies with strong balance sheets have a greater appetite for acquisitions because they can structure all-stock deals that don't take cash out of the business. On the other hand, private equity-backed energy companies may be less likely to acquire competitors because they would need to raise capital in a tight market. Concho makes an attractive acquisition target because it has relatively low amount of debt and desirable assets in the Permian Basin, where scale is needed to compete. Concho has drilling rights on about 800,000 acres in the Permian, which stretches from eastern New Mexico to west Texas, ConocoPhillips said in an investor presentation last month. Conoco has a relatively smaller position in the Permian Basin than some of its peers. That's kind of been an obvious hole. Having a scale in the Permian would be a key driver. Large oil companies such as Exxon and Chevron moved to grab a larger piece of the Permian production in 2019, ramping up output until the oil bust this year forced some to cut back. For ConocoPhillips, a deal with Concho to join the fray in the public prolific shale field would come at a cost, however. Even though everyone is crying out for consolidation, the investment community has not been kind to companies that try to do this, O'Leary said. Their stock price is punished. That's what makes some of these companies shy about pursuing acquisitions. The opinion page. Guest view from the Dallas Morning News. School year should be longer to stop the COVID-19 slide. The coronavirus pandemic has changed everything, from the way we eat to the way we worship. So it's no surprise that it will change the way our children learn. Over the next few months, Dallas ISD leaders will consider proposals to change the school calendar in 2021-22, adding more instruction and more flexibility to the system. We support such a measure as long as it is focused on teaching and sensitive to the needs of families. The crisis is clear. According to an analysis by this newspaper's team of education journalists last month, 19,000 students across 80 North Texas districts essentially dropped out of school by May 1 of this year. More than 100,000 stopped doing assignments before the end of the spring semester. Thousands on the wrong side of the digital divide were left with no reliable connection to the classroom, and the beginning of this school year was uneven, to say the least. Educators worry that many students may have fallen as much as a full year behind. To address this COVID slide, DISD leaders are exploring three options for extending the school year: summer enrichment programs, more breaks in the school calendar during which students could engage in targeted remediation, and extending the school year by as much as 6 weeks with more flexible daily schedules. None of these options would increase the state-mandated 1,260 hours of school. The additional instruction time would be optional. That's reasonable, but we're concerned that optional may tend toward frivolous. DISD Deputy Chief of Academics, Derek Little, said the added instructional days won't be focused solely on catching up from pandemic learning loss. What we're trying to do is allow parents and students to create a customized plan for what they want this time to look like and have those choices be driven by the community's input. Certainly, educators can make room for each student's particular needs and interests, but the reason for additional school days is not for students to find themselves. It's for them to learn the lessons the pandemic has stolen from them. We're also aware that summer is the time when kids go to camp, vacation, or to visit family members who live far away. These are enriching opportunities, and a school calendar should make some room for them. But again, the goal of this effort is learning. DISD must address the learning loss created by the pandemic. Trustee Miguel Solis said, "We're potentially writing off a generation of kids, and the only way that we're going to be able to make up a year plus of learning loss is by filling those gaps by doing something different." We agree. As is the case with so many things in 2020, new circumstances are requiring new solutions. The ISD and other Texas districts cannot expect to return to business as usual, and we cannot afford to write off a year of instruction. An extended school year may be the best way to keep kids on track. Obituaries and death notices. Jerry Franklin Sides left this world to be with Jesus Tuesday, October 13th. He was born October 29th, 1926 in Ranger. His family moved to Odessa in 1938. Due to COVID, a private graveside service will be held. In lieu of flowers, please direct memorials to Manor Park, Jerry and Martha Sides Endowment of Midland. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Pickle and Walsh Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Lula Faye Martin Moore went to be with the Lord on October 13th in Sulphur Springs at the age of 89. She was born in Buckeye, Arizona on February 6, 1931. Funeral services will be held at 2 p.m. Saturday, October 17th at Spence Chapel of First Baptist Church. Interment will follow at Sulphur Springs City Cemetery. Visitation will begin at 1 p.m. prior to the service. Arrangements are under the direction of West Oaks Funeral Home, www.westoaksfuneralhome.com. Welton Douglas Moore went to be with the Lord on October 9th in Sulphur Springs at the age of 94. He was born in Electra, Texas on September 20th, 1926. Funeral services will be held at 2 p.m. Saturday, October 17th at Spence Chapel of First Baptist Church. Military graveside honors by the Hopkins County Military Coalition will follow at Sulphur Springs City Cemetery. Visitation will begin at 1 p.m. prior to service time. Arrangements are under the direction of West Oaks Funeral Home, www.westoaksfuneralhome.com. Guadalupe B. Machuca, 78, peacefully passed away Friday, October 9th at his home in Burney. Funeral services will be held at St. Stephen's Catholic Church on Friday, November 6th at 10 a.m. Homer Garcia Bernard, 61, of Midland, passed away Saturday, October 11th. Viewing will be Friday, October 16th from 12 to 9 p.m. and Saturday, October 17th from 9 to 11 a.m. A rosary will be recited at 7 p.m. on Friday, October 16th at Luella Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home. Funeral Mass is set for Saturday, October 17th at 12 p.m. at Our Lady of Guadalupe Parish and Shrine. Burial will follow in Rest Haven Memorial Park.
Hi, this is Linda. I'm reading the Odessa American for Friday, October 16th, 2020. Section A. Doctors Talk COVID-19 Hospitalizations by Michael Merlot. Medical professionals spoke on the rise of COVID-19-related hospitalizations in Ector County during a Thursday virtual hospital briefing. That's been ranging between 8 and 11% over last week, 6 days, and it peaked at 12, so we're not quite to that 15%, although it is trending upward. Medical Center Hospital Interim Chief Medical Officer Dr. Timothy Benton said, on behalf of the Ector County Health Department. He added that if more than 15% of Ector County beds are used for COVID-19 patients, local county officials may have to make decisions on scaling back restaurant and bar capacity per state mandate. Governor Greg Abbott's executive order GA-32 defined high hospitalizations, quote, as any trauma service area that has had 7 consecutive days in which the number of COVID-19 hospitalized patients as a percentage of all hospital capacity exceeds 15%, end quote. Benton said that as of Thursday, 11% of the total beds that can be staffed in the county are filled with COVID-19 patients. An MCH representative detailed that there are around 500 available operational beds for COVID-19 patients between ORMC and MCH. The Ector County Health Department website detailed that currently 47 COVID-19 patients are hospitalized in the county. 22 of them are in the intensive care unit and 14 are reportedly on ventilators. Out of the 5,556 total COVID-19 cases in the county, 3,448 are confirmed positives, 2,108 are probable positives, and 843 cases are listed as active. While 4,607 people have reportedly recovered from the virus, 106 Ector County residents have reportedly died from COVID-19-related complications. The website also showed that 7.76% of positive COVID-19 patients are hospitalized in the county, a number that includes Ector County residents only. Benton said that the county removed the COVID-19 positivity rate from the Ector County Hospital District website because of a lack of negative tests being reported, which he said makes the positivity rate inaccurate. As of 1:30 p.m. Thursday, Medical Center Hospital detailed in a press release that out of 1,689 positive COVID-19 cases, 35 of those patients are in the hospital at MCH. 23 are on 4 central COVID-19 isolation floor, 12 are in the critical care unit, and 9 of them are on ventilators. The in-hospital patient list includes one patient from Buena Vida Nursing and Rehabilitation Center in Odessa, one from Deering's Nursing and Rehabilitation in Odessa, 2 from Focused Care at Odessa, 1 from Alpine, 1 from Andrews, 2 from Big Spring, 3 from Fort Stockton, 1 from Kermit, 1 from McCamey, 1 from Midland, and 1 from Presidio. Of the total MCH tests, 6,061 have been negative, 45 tests are pending, and no persons under investigation are in the hospital. 15 of the 35 COVID-19 patients in-house are reportedly from nursing homes or out of county transfers. Odessa Regional Medical Center Hospital Chief Medical Officer Dr. Rohith Saravanan detailed that out of 4,046 conducted tests, 3,509 have been negative and 503 patients have tested positive for COVID-19 at ORMC. For COVID-19, 13 COVID-19 positive patients are in the hospital and 5 are on ventilators, he said. A lot more positives came in this week compared to the weeks prior, so that is to keep in mind, Saravanan said. He added that only 4 of the in-hospital patients are from Odessa, while 4 are from Big Spring, 1 is from Pampa, 1 is from Carlsbad, New Mexico, 1 from Fort Stockton, 1 from Van Horn, and 1 from Presidio. Average census this week has been between that 13 and 15. So again, that's higher than it was a few weeks ago. It's not nearly as high as when we had a huge spike in July, but we definitely don't want it to get there, he said, further explaining that increased numbers could put stress on the hospitals. Saravanan also explained the importance of people continuing to practice COVID-19 precautions while out and said that more is at stake than just restaurants and bars if hospitals continue to have more patients past 15%. For the hospitals, elective surgeries will go back to being shut down again, and that's part of the executive order as well, he said. Information regarding Abbott's executive order can be found at https://tinyurl.com/y2jqxrzc. COVID slide sparks concern by Ruth Campbell. The combination of COVID-19 and summer slide has taken a toll on Ector County ISD students, Superintendent Scott Murray said in his weekly media call. March 5th was the last day of school in a face-to-face environment, he said Wednesday. Students stayed remote through May and into the summer months and did not participate in learning activities. Currently, 38% of students are learning remotely. The remote learning percentages are higher with older students. At the Tuesday board workshop, Murray said attendance is down about 2%. In secondary schools, the number of Fs is up 7%. The number of students who failed one or more courses in the first 6 weeks increased from 15% to 40% compared to 1 year ago. He added that the COVID slide anticipated from last spring's school closure is showing up in the first round of MAP, Measures of Academic Progress testing, where math and English language arts are low. The MAP test is given 3 times per year to monitor student growth throughout the year. Murray said without a great learning experience this year, kids will not hit the achievement marks set out for them. Many of our students in ECISD have lost over a year's worth of learning in just the last few months. That's because they're not engaged in a learning process. They're not participating in virtual learning experiences. The summer was not healthy for them. And as we started the school year for some of our students, they're still not engaging effectively. And so as a result, we've seen some pretty dramatic academic losses that our students have experienced. He noted that it has impacted students at every level from pre-kindergarten through 12th grade. We are addressing those concerns as an organization, but we understand that meeting the needs of our kids is bigger than just ECISD. It's an all-hands-on-deck opportunity. Now, more than ever, moms and dads and grandparents and uncles, cousins, relatives, friends of our students, we need to do all that we can to help our students and ensure that they are learning every single day. Our kids who are in a face-to-face environment have that opportunity to engage with a teacher, but about 38% of our students are currently learning in a virtual environment. It's critically important those kids are supported while they're in their home. They're given a quiet place to do their work. They have internet access. They have one of the new devices that's provided by ECISD. That there's an adult in the room with them to respond to any questions or to make sure that they stay on task. It is critically important that our parents follow up with their children to make sure that homework assignments are submitted, that learning continues, Murray said. I would encourage our parents to have daily conversations with children about what they're learning. Really quiz them. Any of our parents who have concerns, reach out immediately to your child's teacher. We as a community have a lot of work to do on behalf of our children because, again, the learning loss that we are seeing is very significant and we must address that immediately. Murray said the district is working diligently to put plans in place and activate the plans it already has in place to ensure that students are learning daily. In fact, in addition to our data last night, we heard conversation and a report from our curriculum team about the ways we are supporting virtual learning, supporting our teachers, ensuring that they have really powerful tools, digital tools in which to work, ways in which our teachers are engaging our kids in a virtual learning environment, Murray added. He implores the community to support its children and teachers today, along with those who are actively engaged in student learning, to help them make up for all the learning that has been lost during the pandemic. Many of our students engage in math manipulatives in their environment, but because of COVID-19, and again, many of our students are in a digital world, we now have access to digital math manipulatives we're providing for our students so that mathematics can be something that students touch and feel. Murray said, "We're providing job-embedded coaching for our teachers. Many of our teachers who are teaching in the virtual world, it's a new experience for them. So in conjunction with a program from the Texas Education Agency, are providing job-embedded coaching to our teachers so that they can improve their skills and engage more effectively the students in ECISD," he added. ECISD has purchased 37,000 new devices for students, including iPads and Chromebooks. "We're working on the broadband problem. In the short term, we're providing hotspots and then free access to our local cable providers for 1 year. Those opportunities are available to our parents in ECISD. We're also working on a long-range broadband project to make sure that those students who remain at home have access to high-quality broadband within their home environment," Murray said. The COVID slide was anticipated. If you remember, we had a conversation, I believe it was in May. One of our ECISD live events spoke very specifically about the COVID slide, and that was based on predictive analytics, looking at data that indicated that our students may experience the COVID slide. And the data we now saw last night, October 13th, was evidence that our students in ECISD have proven that claim to be true, that students, because of the pandemic and being out of school and then throughout the summer, could experience up to a full year of loss. And that happened, Murray said. He added that not all students experienced learning loss. Some students have done better in a virtual world and are performing at an even higher level than they did prior to the pandemic. But for many of our students, the pandemic has created a really challenging learning environment for them that became true in the data we saw last night, pre-K through 12th grade, Murray said. If students have an average school experience, if school is normal for them this year, the vast majority would not be successful on the STAR or end-of-course exam. What that says to us as educators is our students must have a better than average school experience this year in order for them to be successful because they have experienced such a significant loss, Murray said. Data from Tuesday showed that in math and reading, your average fifth grader is actually not in the fifth grade academically. They're more like a third or fourth grader because of the COVID slide. So in order for that child to be successful on the fifth grade STAR this year, they have a lot of makeup to do, not only learning what they missed last year, but ensuring that they have high quality learning experience this year. Our kids deserve more than average. They deserve excellence. And if that doesn't happen to them in the classroom or the virtual learning environment, they don't receive the kind of support they need from their family and from their community, our kids will struggle mightily, he said. Highway named after road champion. City unveils memorial for Odessan Ray C. Stoker Jr. by Royal McGregor. As the sounds of low-level traffic whizzed by on Highway 191 and East Loop 338, Craig Stoker shared a specific memory about his late father, Ray C. Stoker Jr., and his ability to accomplish tasks while nobody was watching. Craig Stoker said when he was younger, his father would say after family meals that the dish fairy would clean all the dishes. Stoker continued to explain that while everyone was asleep, the dishes were done and clean in the morning. Stoker said his father also garnered the nickname Road Fairy because he championed road projects like Highway 191 and a complete loop around Odessa during the nighttime to avoid problems throughout the day. We know that he spent many hours that were unpaid and unrecognized, Stoker said of his late father. Knowing that's what's going to drive the future, that's what's going to drive commerce, that's what's going to drive the city. Without these projects that he worked so hard on, we would be in a real mess. Thursday afternoon at UTPB Park, the city of Odessa held a ceremony that unveiled one of the two signs that will honor Ray C. Stoker Jr. on East Loop 338. City Manager Michael Marrero said one of the signs will be placed near the intersection of Highway 191 and East Loop 338, while the other sign will be located further south on East Loop 338. Carol Stoker, the widow of Ray Stoker Jr., said it will be special for citizens for Odessa to drive past those signs to show the level of pride her late husband took in the community. A lot of people probably won't know who he was, but they will know that he was someone who meant something to the city, and that means something to me, Carol Stoker said. Ray C. Stoker Jr. died August 31st, 2018, at age 79 from pulmonary fibrosis. He was born and raised in Odessa, graduated from Odessa High School and Baylor University. He was an attorney, clerk for the Texas Supreme Court, and served as the first chairman of the Texas Department of Transportation. In addition to words from Craig Stoker about his father, District 2 Councilmember Dewey Bryant, District 4 Councilmember Tom Sprawls, and former District Judge Tryon Lewis of Odessa spoke about Ray C. Stoker Jr. Lewis said he practiced law with Ray C. Stoker and worked on community matters with him. Lewis also said that he could talk forever about Ray C. Stoker Jr. and all the things that he accomplished. We are fortunate that Ray was in this community, as we are fortunate that his family is in this community, Lewis said. COVID-19 news by the numbers. Ector County total cases, both confirmed and probable, 5,556. Ector County negative, 24,682 out of 30,585 tested, with 347 pending, 106 deaths. Recovered, 4,607. Active, 843. ECISD daily cases, 6 students, 4 staff. Midland County, 4,347 confirmed, 87 deaths. Texas, 809,808 confirmed, with 7,111,890 tested. Total Texas deaths, 16,812. U.S. cases, 7,894,768 total confirmed, and 216,025 deaths. Find out more at co.ector.tx.us or dshs.state.tx.us or the CDC site at tinyurl.com/TZTRJLF. See the ECISD COVID-19 dashboard at tinyurl.com/Y6NTP. Quick hits. Have you voted? Early voting continues through October 30th. The Ector County Courthouse Annex, 1010 East 8th Street, room 104. Early voting hours are scheduled from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. through Friday, and October 19th through 23rd, 7 a.m. to 7 p.m., October 24th and 26th through 28th, and 29th and 30th, 1 p.m. to 6 p.m., October 25th. 4 other voting locations will take place from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. today, October 19th through 23rd, 8 a.m. to 6 p.m., October 24th, 1 p.m. to 6 p.m., October 25th, 8 a.m. to 6 p.m., October 26th and 28th, 7 a.m. to 7 p.m., October 29th and 30th, at Kellis Turner Community Building, 2230 Sycamore Drive, Westlake Hardware Store, 4652 East University, the Globe Theater at Odessa College, 2308 Shakespeare Road, and Salinas Community Building, 600 West Clements. So far in Ector County, 9,818 have voted. For sample ballots or more information, call 498-4030 or visit www.co.ector.tx.us/page/ector.elections. Community sweep. The City of Odessa has scheduled a code enforcement community sweep drive-through from 8 to 11 a.m. Saturday at UTPB Park, East Loop 338 and Highway 191. Odessa is invited to drop off bulky items and properly dispose of free of charge. Drop off bulky items such as refrigerators, mattresses, yard equipment, furniture, water heaters, and more. For more information, call 335-4680 or visit tinyurl.com/Y7SLYAM. To report or for more code violation information, call 257-0572 or visit odessa-tx.gov/code. MCH reports 83rd COVID-19 related death. A 70-year-old woman died Wednesday night from COVID-19 related complications, a medical center hospital press release detailed. MCH is reporting this as the 83rd COVID-19 related death. The woman had pre-existing conditions, was a La Mesa resident, and had arrived just hours prior to her death. The family has been notified. As of Thursday night, MCH currently has 34 COVID-19 patients in-house. The critical care unit has 12 patients with 9 on ventilators. 22 patients are on 4 Central, the COVID isolation floor, the release stated. Grad returns to head OHS orchestra by Ruth Campbell. An Odessa High School graduate has come home to helm his alma mater's orchestra. This is Seth Bedford's first year as orchestra director. It's interesting, it's surreal, and it's good, and it's really an interesting experience. I'm really enjoying it. I feel like it's a really good chance for me to reconnect with the community, and it's been a really positive thing for me, the Big Spring native said. Bedford attended Midland College, then transferred to the University of Texas at Austin, where he earned a degree in music composition and received his teaching certificate from Texas State University. He taught in Austin and was then offered a teaching position at PS 58 in Brooklyn. After 2 years in Brooklyn, Bedford said he began teaching artist work for the Metropolitan Opera Guild. I did work for the Orchestra of St. Luke's in New York, more composition-based things, and then at some point I started getting really into teaching private lessons. I was working at the Brooklyn Music School, and then about 2017, I had the opportunity to teach at a private school in Ohio, which I took and I loved. Then this sort of rolled across my way, and I thought it was time to give Texas another look, Bedford said. There are about 60 students in orchestra this year, and Bedford is teaching online and in person due to COVID-19. It's interesting. It's a challenge, and I think it's a challenge for everybody who's doing it, but I feel like we're finally hitting a really good balance point with it. The kids are really feeling more connected to it. I think that's the big challenge, is having them feel invested, like they're connected, he added. Bedford said the students are used to having a concert in October. We're honoring that by having them do a video. They're going to be on stage of course, distanced out, but they're going to have an opportunity that way to present the work they are doing so far, Bedford said. He added that he's sometimes able to have a larger group meet after school, and they are sounding good. I think what's really been the big thing is just their confidence this year. I think a lot of kids are feeling very shot out of a cannon, and they don't know me as well. They're getting to know me a lot better, and they're starting to feel a little more in it, so it's coming together nicely. I'm looking forward to their trajectory over the year, Bedford said. Working in various capacities, Bedford has been in education for about 18 years altogether. In New York, he balanced a career as a composer with teaching. When I was at the University of Texas, I really had no intention of being an educator. I think I had that really silly arrogance that a lot of students have. No, teaching is the thing you fall back on. I'm not going to do it. But I really was getting more and more interested in it. Like I said, I was involved in the String Project, which is a Suzuki-based teacher training program. I had this idea that I'm going to be a composer. I don't know what that means, but I'm going to do it, Bedford recalled. When a position opened up in Austin, suddenly a high school friend of Bedford's suggested that he apply. It changed everything, he said. What ended up happening was I was working simultaneously on my teaching certificate while I taught. Virginia Luman, Bedford's orchestra director in high school, is the reason Bedford said he's now teaching. I think the thing that was so amazing about her was she's the first adult that I ever encountered who really just was herself, Bedford said. She was a character, and that really spoke to me. That kind of taught me a little bit about who you can be when you're grown. You really do sort of get to live life on your terms. You get to be your own person. That's one thing that I really loved about her. She was so supportive and inspiring, and she was never afraid to make mistakes. Bedford said he grew up playing the cello, but at some point he started getting drawn into viola. He finished UT on cello and began viola lessons in New York. Since then, I've gotten back into cello, but I do both pretty equally, he said. What appealed to Bedford about the cello was that the first time he had something that people paid attention to. It was the first time I felt like I could express myself in a meaningful way, and it really kind of opened up my world, he added. As a student, Bedford said he wasn't emotionally invested in school and thought about dropping out for about the first half of high school. He said he had really excellent teachers who cared about him and wanted him to do well. Cello was what got him through. What kept me was being in my school orchestra and knowing that if I was ever going to have this career as a musician and artist, that I had to go to university. The only way I was really going to do that is by graduating from here, Bedford said. He still composes as well. The University of Texas Permian Basin has asked him for a piece that they are going to perform in the spring. It's concert music. The piece is scored for orchestra narrator. It's a piece that I wrote for the Chelsea Symphony in 2017 in New York City, and it's since been done by the Jackson Symphony in Michigan, Bedford said. Through his teaching, Bedford said he tries to let students know they can accomplish their dreams as well. Director of Fine Arts, Aaron Halling, said the district is excited to have Bedford on board. He brings a wealth of experience, and like he said, he is from this area, so I think he knows of the challenges with Odessa, but at the same time, he brings a wealth of experience to challenge us to be even better, Holly said.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.